The scab has been ripped off. I'm Pam Kutha, Fox News. That from House Democrat Tim Ryan following yesterday's death of Capitol Police Officer William Evans. The tragedy follows January's riot at the Capitol.
Police say a suspect who Fox has identified as 25-year-old Noah Green, originally from Indiana, rammed his blue Nissan into two Capitol Police officers guarding the main Senate entrance to the Capitol. The car then crashed into a barricade. Police say Green jumped out and lunged at the officers with what was described as a cross between a machete and a kitchen knife. Police fired on Green, killing him.
Fox's Chad Pergram. Fencing that was erected after the riot had started to come down, but the latest breach has officials again reassessing security. Boycott Major League Baseball. That's what former President Trump is calling for after the league decided to move its All-Star game out of Georgia following passage of new voting laws. Opponents argue the laws are too restrictive and disenfranchise people of color. Georgia's Republican Governor Brian Kemp spoke last night to Fox's Tucker Carlson.
Major League Baseball has folded up and caved to the cancel culture and a bunch of liberal lies.
In a statement, Major League Baseball said it supports voting rights for all Americans. More damaging testimony against the former police officer charged with murdering George Floyd.
The most senior officer of the Minneapolis Police Force, Lieutenant Richard Zimmerman, on the stand speaking very critically of former officer Derek Chauvin using his knee on George Floyd's neck as Floyd was handcuffed on the ground. Zimmerman telling the court that Chauvin escalated his use of force on a handcuffed Floyd to the top tier, deadly force.
Fox's Matt Finn, the defense says Zimmerman no longer patrols the streets. America's listening to Fox News. Republicans are pledging to battle the Biden administration every step of the way over its $2 trillion infrastructure plan. The GOP claims it's too expensive and includes progressive pet projects. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki says infrastructure is not a partisan issue.
Access to broadband is an issue that is certainly the case of a challenge, I should say, in inner cities and lower income communities, but is also an issue across rural America, many parts of the country that are redder in the political sense and have more predominantly Republican populations.
Republicans also object to the president's plan to raise corporate tax rates to pay for the proposal. In less than 2 weeks, indoor concerts and theater performances will be permitted in California, provided some new rules are followed. For starters, people will either have to be tested for the coronavirus or show proof of full vaccination. In addition, capacity will depend on the level of restrictions in a particular county. The state is divided into four tiers based on how widespread the virus is. Governor Gavin Newsom continues to urge residents to wear masks and practice social distancing. Some COVID-19 curveballs from Major League Baseball as one team starts off the season with a handful of positive cases.
Washington Nationals General Manager Mike Rizzo providing an update Friday on the COVID concerns for the Nats that have led to the postponement of their opening series against the New York Mets.
The player that we told you yesterday was a likely positive has been confirmed a positive. So in total, we have four confirmed positives right now.
The Nationals had gone all of spring training without a positive coronavirus test. When they'll open their 2021 season remains unknown for now, while the New York Mets are now preparing to open their season Monday against the Philadelphia Phillies.
I shared our sympathy with the Nationals. It could happen to anybody.
Mets manager Louis Rojas.
Fox's Matt Napolitano. Pam Puso, Fox News.
In D.C. on the Anacostia Freeway, northbound, there is road construction. Roadway is reduced to one lane between the 11th Street Bridge and Pennsylvania Avenue. On the southbound side of 295 right there, the roadway is reduced down to one lane between Pennsylvania Avenue and the 11th Street Bridge. In Beltsville on Route 1, southbound, there is construction. Two right lanes are closed between Montgomery Road and Edgewood Road. And in Laurel, there is a crash on 95 southbound. The left lane is blocked right at 216 exit 35. And now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Mostly sunny skies on this Saturday. Also some warmer temperatures. Highs yesterday only reached the upper 40s. We should reach the upper 50s, a good 10 degrees warmer for this Saturday. Heading into tonight, low temperatures in the 30s in the suburbs, lower 40s around town. For your Easter Sunday, plenty of sunshine for the day. Temperatures very mild, a gorgeous day ahead of us. High temperatures in the upper 60s. Enjoy your Sunday. I'm 7 News meteorologist Alex Lee at the Stormwatch 7 Weather Center.
Now, the Saturday morning update.
105.9 FM.
Good morning. It is the Saturday Morning Update. I'm Rick Fowler. Jeff Wolf is behind the console. Jane Houghton, our producer this morning. And what should have been a happy Easter and a happy end of Passover weekend started out as a tragic weekend, of course, at the U.S. Capitol yesterday. And I'm sure you've heard by now that Capitol Police Officer William Billy Evans was killed when a man reportedly identified as Noah Green rammed a car into a barrier at the Capitol. Now, this is the barrier that is on Constitution Avenue. It's on the Union Station side of the Capitol as you come up the long hill on Constitution Avenue toward the Senate office buildings. It's that entrance right at the side of the Capitol. And the U.S. Capitol Police confirmed that a second officer who was injured in that attack yesterday is in stable condition and is not facing life-threatening injuries. Yogananda Pittman is the acting chief of the U.S. Capitol Police. They held a press conference yesterday afternoon at about 2:45. She explains exactly what happened.
At approximately 1:02 hours this afternoon, a suspect entered what we refer to as the North Barricade of the Capitol. The suspect rammed his car into two of our officers and then hit the North Barricade barrier. At such time, the suspect exited the vehicle with a knife in hand. Our officers then engaged that suspect. He did not respond to verbal commands. The suspect did start lunging toward U.S. Capitol Police officers, at which time U.S. Capitol Police officers fired upon the suspect. At this time, the suspect has been pronounced deceased. Two U.S. Capitol Police officers were transported to two different hospitals, and it is with a very, very heavy heart that I announce one of our officers has succumbed to his injuries. We are not able to release any information, names, age, date of birth, or anything of that nature at this time.
That was the announcement yesterday afternoon, and of course we have gotten further details since then. We'll talk further about this morning. We'll talk with Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer. He'll have more on the suspect and also more on security at the U.S. Capitol. Other news this morning that we're covering, what should have been a happy All-Star game for Major League Baseball in Atlanta is not going to be in Atlanta now at this point. It follows criticism of the Georgia voting law from President Joe Biden. Now, this has really heated up. Delta Airlines is in the mix. Coca-Cola is in the mix. And what we're going to do here is we're going to talk about, number one, Joe Biden's comments. And then the governor of Georgia was on with Tucker Carlson last night. He had follow-up comments. And a lot of the question has to do with the election day voting hours during the run-up in the early voting in Georgia. Now, as a backdrop, I would like to read this from the Washington Post. Post gave Joe Biden four Pinocchios on what you're about to hear in Joe Biden's comments, and this has created some controversy. Remember how President Trump at the time was accused of misrepresentations and falsehoods, and it got to the point where the Post and CNN, everybody, just about anything Trump said, they would precede it with the word falsely claimed. Well, it seems to be a pattern now with Joe Biden. In fact, the headline on the fact-checking article in the Washington Post is President Biden Recidivist, which is, it's quite a compliment for a guy that's only been there nearly 70 days now. The Post did give him four Pinocchios, and we'll let you hear now what President Biden said that has created the controversy and has earned him four Pinocchios from the Washington Post fact checkers.
What I'm worried about is how un-American this whole initiative is. It's sick. It's sick. Deciding in some states that you cannot bring water to people standing in line waiting to vote. Deciding that you're going to end voting at 5 o'clock when working people are just getting off work.
So here's what the Washington Post said, the fact checkers. In reality, election day hours were not changed, and the opportunities to cast a ballot in early voting were expanded. The law made a modest change, replacing a vague phrase, normal business hours, presumed to be 9 a.m. to 5 p.m., to a more specific 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. time period. Under the new laws, counties have the option to extend the voting hours so voters can start casting ballots as early as 7 a.m. and as late as 7 p.m., the same as Election Day in Georgia. Moreover, an additional mandatory day of early voting on Saturday was added, and 2 days of early voting on Sunday were codified as an option for counties. But as President Biden said, it's sick. It's sick. It's Jim Crow. Now, there's all this controversy over water. You can't bring water wearing a Republican or a Democratic campaign T-shirt to somebody within a certain distance of the polling place. It's electioneering. You know that. You've seen that in Washington or Maryland or Virginia. Their tables have to be a certain distance away from the polling place. People can still bring water to people in line. So all the voters in Georgia are not going to dehydrate. Here's how Governor Brian Kemp summed it up last night with Tucker Carlson.
This is unbelievable. I mean, really unfortunate today, obviously, that Major League Baseball has folded up and caved to the cancel culture and a bunch of liberal lies, quite honestly. And what's even more sad is the president of the United States, Joe Biden, and people like Stacey Abrams labeling the Election Integrity Act Jim Crow. This is what happens. You know, now you have a lot of small business owners, a lot of great baseball fans, including myself, or they're getting deprived of having the All-Star game in Atlanta because of a cancel culture. And I think it's a message to all of us all across this country that are at home tonight. They're coming after you next. You know, they're going to come after your ball game. They're going to boycott your business. If you don't agree with their way of life, they're going to come after you on that too.
You know, it's interesting when you hear stories like this, the hypocrisy of the media, the Democratic Party, the way they interpret things. Now, Governor Kemp continued with Tucker Carlson and really put that hypocrisy into context here.
Well, look, it's so hypocritical, too. It's just like Major League Baseball headquartered in New York. Delta's flying to New York. I'm sure Coca-Cola sells a lot of product in New York. When you look at New York's voting laws, you have to have an excuse to vote absentee by mail in New York. You do not in Georgia. Just if you want to vote absentee here, you can do it. We have 17 days of in-person early voting before the election for people to participate. We now have two more optional days if counties opt into that on Sundays that was in this bill that's actually expanding access for voting opportunities early. New York has 10, so we have either 7 or 9 days more than New York where Major League Baseball is headquartered. I guess we should be boycotting, you know, them for having their headquarters in New York because that law is more restricted than ours. I mean, this is all ridiculous. This bill simply changes a signature requirement for absentee ballots and uses voter ID. We've been using voter ID, Tucker, in Georgia since the mid-2000s.
Okay, so that's a sense from Brian Kemp, the governor of Georgia, on Tucker Carlson on Fox last night. Now, here's an interesting contrast. Delta Airlines, of course, they're headquartered in Atlanta. They've jumped into the fray. Now, earlier in the week, Delta Airlines put out a statement at their Delta News website, and here's what they said earlier in the week. And listen kind of carefully because I'm going to play the comments of the Delta CEO from yesterday. But here's what Delta said earlier in the week, and they were involved in the state elections officials negotiations. So Delta's involved in this all along. Okay, so here's what they said. The legislation signed this week improved considerably during the legislative process and expands weekend voting, codifies Sunday voting, and protects a voter's ability to cast an absentee ballot without providing a reason. For the first time, drop boxes have also been authorized for all counties statewide, and poll workers will be allowed to work across county lines. Very positive comments there from Delta Airlines. They did go on to say, nonetheless, we understand concerns remain over other provisions in the legislation, and there continues to be work ahead in this important effort. But you heard the very positive comments about the expanded provisions, the expanded voting opportunities in the legislation. That was from the Delta News site. Well, the cancel mob came in and got to the Delta CEO, Ed Bastian, because this is what he had to say about it yesterday.
This is about protecting the voices of our people. When I speak to our people, particularly within the Black community, we're here in Atlanta. We've got a very, very large Black employee base. Almost universally, they are hurt by the law and the legislation that was enacted, and we need to make certain their voices are heard. We spent a lot of time in the last year reaching out to those most vulnerable and telling them that we hear them, that we see them, that their voices matter. And if we can't stand with them now, when will we?
Huh. Funny how that changed during the week, isn't it? And, by the way, there's one little note to add on to the end of all of this. The Atlanta Journal-Constitution had to issue a correction to an article that basically had echoed President Biden's remarks. In the correction, they said the newspaper had incorrectly reported the new law would limit voting hours. In the correction, it says, quote, nothing in the new law changes those rules. So the newspaper can't get it right, and everybody else is changing their tune, and Major League Baseball moves the All-Star game out of Atlanta. They haven't decided where they're going to put it. It is 6:21. It is the Saturday morning update on WMAL. Al BD is in the WMAL Traffic Center this morning.
In Laurel on 95 southbound, heads up, there is a crash. Left lane is blocked at Maryland 216, exit 35. There is also a crash in Jessup on the VW Parkway southbound. That has been moved to the right shoulder. This is just before Maryland 32. In Beltsville on Route 1, Baltimore Avenue southbound, there is construction. Two right lanes are closed between Montgomery Road and Edgewood Road. And in D.C. on 295, northbound and southbound, there is construction. Only one lane is getting by between the 11th Street Bridge and Pennsylvania Avenue. And now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Mostly sunny skies on this Saturday. Also, some warmer temperatures. Highs yesterday only reached the upper 40s. We should reach the upper 50s, a good 10 degrees warmer for this Saturday. Heading into tonight, low temperatures in the 30s in the suburbs, lower 40s around town. For your Easter Sunday, plenty of sunshine for the day. Temperatures very mild. A gorgeous day ahead of us. High temperatures in the upper 60s. Enjoy your Sunday. I'm 7 News meteorologist Alex Lee at the Stormwatch 7 Weather Center.
Currently in the nation's capital, it's 30 degrees. 6:22 on the Saturday morning update on WMAL.
Washington's Mall, WMAL, where Washington comes to talk.
And it is the Saturday morning update. I'm Rick Fowler. Thank you for joining us, and we do hope that you do have a nice Easter weekend and a nice Passover weekend. And again, so sad that the weekend started off with the death of a U.S. Capitol police officer. Tragedy at Capitol Hill yesterday. Want to turn to the border, another tragic situation. The numbers are out for March, and 171,000 migrants were apprehended at the border. They don't mention how many were not apprehended. They are now projecting that in fiscal year 2021, a projected 184,000 unaccompanied minors will enter the United States across the southern border. And we've heard the controversy. The Secretary of Homeland Security, Alejandro Mayorkas, says the border is closed and the border is secure. Line up a few Pinocchios for him. Another misrepresentation from the Biden administration. Isn't it interesting when it's the Biden administration, it's misrepresentation. When it's the Trump administration, it's lies. Funny thing about semantics, isn't it? Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, though, she's got the solution now. Some of the migrants who have come across the border, AOC, calling for reparations.
The fact that this keeps happening over and over and over again is a political failure by both parties. What is happening here is not the same as what happened during the Trump administration, where they took babies out of the arms of their mothers. Those families are owed reparations, period.
So that's Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and her solution to things on the border. And we're going to give just a little taste of the back and forth. As you know, Fox's Peter Doocy has been the thorn in the side of the Biden administration from a media standpoint, because very few other reporters are pressing the Biden administration. And how big of a thorn is Peter Doocy? He is such a large thorn in the side that they will not call on him in the presidential news conferences. Now, Jen Psaki does call on him. You can see the look on her face when she's dealing with Peter Doocy. Next time he asks a question, just watch her body language. Watch the expressions. She is so annoyed. It's obvious. Anyway, we're going to play just some of the back and forth. Peter Doocy asking the White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki about what the administration will do on border security.
And then on immigration, has the White House considered beefing up border security now that there is video of a 3-year-old and a 5-year-old being thrown over the wall in New Mexico?
Beefing up border security.
There's video now of a 3-year-old and a 5-year-old.
I've seen the video, and I think any of us who saw the video were incredibly alarmed by the steps of smugglers, ones that we have been quite familiar with, that we've spoken out about our concerns about. As Secretary Mayorkas said, the inhumane way smugglers abuse children while profiting off parents' desperation is criminal and morally reprehensible. President certainly agrees with that. And these kids, I believe, were rescued from by individuals who are working at the border.
Yes, but they still got close enough, as you guys are talking about addressing root causes in the region, for a smuggler to throw them over a wall into the desert. And I'm just curious what the White House is doing to stop that from happening.
And are you concerned more about the kids' safety, or are you concerned about kids getting in, or tell me more about your concern here?
Kids' safety is, as you just mentioned, the main concern.
Well, of course it is, which is why I'm often surprised by some of the line of questioning here. But I will say that our concern and our focus is on sending a clear message to the region that this is not the time to come. You should not send your kids on this treacherous journey, that these smugglers are preying on vulnerabilities in these communities. There's a lot of issues and steps we need to take to address root causes. So, of course, our concern is for the safety of these kids. These Border Patrol agents who save these kids deserve our thanks and our gratitude for ensuring their safety.
And that's Peter Doocy with the White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki earlier this week. We're at 6:27. It is the Saturday Morning Update on WMAL. We'll talk further about this with Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer this morning. Jennifer Harper will be joining us next, and she's got some interesting insight into the political scene and some of the messaging from President Biden. Also, we'll be talking with Jim Trusty. He'll bring us up to date on the Derek Chauvin trial, the police officer charged in the death of George Floyd in Minneapolis. That trial 1 week underway now, and Jim Trusty will have highlights and perspective of the testimony that we've seen and heard so far this week. We're going to be talking with John Gizzi, and he'll have his perspective on the attack at the Capitol yesterday. Also, the latest on the contested election in Iowa, even though it was finally certified a Republican victory with 6-vote margin. Speaker Pelosi had threatened to unseat the Republican victor. Well, the outcome has been now decided, and we'll tell you what that is, and John Gizzi will give you the background on it. And John also spoke with the Secretary of State in the Trump administration, Mike Pompeo. John had a lengthy discussion with Mike Pompeo, and we're going to give you the details on that, some interesting revelations from the former Secretary of State and what he will be doing in the future in terms of the Republican elections. So that's coming up in the 7 o'clock hour. And, of course, K.T. McFarland will join us with her perspectives on the activities in the Biden administration. It's all on the way, so do stay with us right here on the Saturday Morning Update on WMAL. In the headlines at 6:30, the U.S. Capitol police officer who died after a man rammed his car into a barricade at the U.S. Capitol, hitting him and another officer identified as an 18-year veteran of the U.S. Capitol Police, William Billy Evans, joined the department in 2003, was a member of its first responders unit. The House Speaker Nancy Pelosi hailed Evans as a martyr for our democracy. The Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer said he was heartbroken. The death, the latest in the moments of sorrow for a department after the loss of Brian Sicknick, who clashed with rioters during the January 6th riots at the Capitol. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis has issued an executive order banning businesses from requiring customers to show proof they've been vaccinated against COVID-19 in order to get service. In the executive order, DeSantis asserts that, quote, vaccination passports reduce individual freedom and will harm patient privacy. As of this week, more than 2 million Floridians have been infected by the virus, 33,500 deaths in Florida. The University of California is warning students and staff that a ransomware group may have stolen and published their personal data, and that hundreds of other schools, government agencies, and companies nationwide. The school this week said a cybersecurity attack targeted a vulnerability in a third-party vendor that is used to securely transfer files. The university system said on Friday the cyber attack affected about 300 organizations. They include Stanford University School of Medicine, Yeshiva University in New York City, university systems in Miami, Maryland, and Colorado, and a Washington State agency. 6:33 on WMAL, and Al BD is in the WMAL Traffic Center this morning.
On the Anacostia Freeway, DC 295, there is construction in both directions, northbound and southbound, where the road is down to only one lane. You'll find it between 11th Street Bridge and Pennsylvania Avenue. In Virginia, on the outer loop of the Beltway in Merrifield, at 66 exit 49, the right lane of that off-ramp from the outer loop to westbound 66 is closed. Only the left is getting by. You can expect delays onto the Beltway. In Beltsville, on Route 1, Baltimore Avenue southbound, there is construction. Two right lanes are closed. You'll find it between Montgomery Road and Edgewood Road. And now, from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL StormWatch 7 forecast.
Mostly sunny skies on this Saturday. Also, some warmer temperatures. Highs yesterday only reached the upper 40s. We should reach the upper 50s, a good 10 degrees warmer for this Saturday. Heading into tonight, low temperatures in the 30s in the suburbs, lower 40s around town. For your Easter Sunday, plenty of sunshine for the day. Temperatures very mild. A gorgeous day ahead of us. High temperatures in the upper 60s. Enjoy your Sunday. I'm 7 News meteorologist Alex Lee at the StormWatch 7 Weather Center.
The temperature has dropped to 28 degrees in the nation's capital, 6:34 on WMAL. Saturday Morning Update for Easter weekend. So glad you've joined us, and we are glad that Jennifer Harper joins us every weekend. She writes Inside the Beltway at the Washington Times. Good morning.
Good morning, and happy Easter, everyone.
Since the new administration has come in and we've seen questions about who's in charge, that does beg the question of what is really going on in the White House, and you have an article about it this week in Inside the Beltway.
I do, actually. I found someone who really described the new presidency in a very, very adept way. And, you know, you have to wonder, President Biden's only been in office for, like, what is it, like 74 days now, and a lot of people think it's more like 74 years, but we'll leave that alone this morning. But anyway, a gentleman named Charles Lipson, he is a professor emeritus of international politics at the University of Chicago. He's also a contributor to RealClearPolitics.com. He had a very tidy summation of the presidential performance so far, and this is what he had to say. Joe Biden was elected as a moderate-left Democrat, but he is not governing as one. He He pledged repeatedly to work across party lines, but he is ramming through the biggest, most expensive progressive agenda in American history without any Republican votes. He is almost certain to try it again with his next two spending proposals, the largest since Lyndon Johnson's Great Society programs. As the White House pushes these mammoth bills with only Democratic votes, Americans are realizing they got a very different president from the one they bargained for, the one they were promised during the campaign. What's unclear is whether they will recoil from this new reality. Again, this is coming from Charles Lipson. He says the result is a president determined to pass everything on the Democrats' all-you-can-eat menu, even if he has to do it with strict party line votes. As a candidate, Joe Biden promised voters a center-left agenda and bipartisanship. As a president, he is giving them neither. Biden's deception is based on the oldest marketing technique in the book, bait and switch. Again, that's coming from Charles Lipson, the bait and switch presidency. I was kind of tickled by that.
Well, while we're on the president and politics, the $2 trillion infrastructure plan has been introduced by President Biden. And what is the Republican Party's reaction?
I actually like their reaction very much. And we have to remember that $2 trillion, that has 12 zeros after it. And I'd like to write that out myself just to realize how much money that is, because I don't do math. But anyway, some very eagle-eyed Republicans have examined all of the available data about this plan, and they have revealed that only 7% of this behemoth price tag, Rick, is actually allocated to what Americans traditionally think of as infrastructure. That's like roads, bridges, waterways, ports, airports, that kind of stuff. And this is coming from the Republican National Committee. They did all of this research, and they said, that's right, of Biden's $2.25 trillion bill, only $115 billion is allocated for repairing roads and bridges, only $25 billion for airports, and only $17 billion is for waterways and ports. And to pay for his non-infrastructure bill, Biden is proposing $1.8 trillion in tax hikes that would kill hundreds of thousands of jobs and raise the combined tax rate on U.S. businesses to the highest of any country in the G7, or also the OECD, that's the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, and that includes 37 other nations. So anyway, our friends at the Republican National Committee conclude, reckless spending, higher taxes, and a less competitive business environment, that's not the plan America needs as it recovers from a pandemic. That's a recipe for fewer jobs and less money in Americans' pockets, all to appease the far-left special interest groups occupying the swamp in Washington, D.C. So that's kind of your $2 trillion report for this morning.
Speaking of appeasing the progressives, cancel culture has been sweeping the nation, and you have two fine examples from this week?
Yeah, they're kind of two hair-raising examples. And first, the word surge, S-U-R-G-E, has just been canceled by none other than our friend Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez of New York. And she has a problem with the use of the term surge to describe the thousands of migrants that are massing at the southern U.S. border and hoping to cross that border in response to Mr. Biden's open-door immigration policies. And, of course, underage kids are part of the throng. We all know this. And so here's what she had to say on her own Instagram live video this week. She says, anyone who's using the term surge around you consciously is trying to invoke a militaristic frame. And that's a problem because this is not a surge. These are children. They are not insurgents, and we are not being invaded, which is, by the way, is a white supremacist idea, a philosophy that if an other is coming into the population, that this is an invasion of who we are. Again, this is coming from Ms. Ocasio-Cortez in her commentary. So I kind of looked up on Merriam-Webster Dictionary and their definition of surge, and they describe it as to rise suddenly to an excessive or abnormal value, and they use it to describe the movement of the sea, the stock market, electrical voltage, lots of other things. And the first known usage of the word surge occurred in 1511. So that's according to Merriam-Webster. And one other bit of canceled, this should appeal to our listeners this morning. This is coming from a Harvard-Harris poll that was released to The Hill this week. They say that the majority of Americans say that they view cancel culture as a threat to their freedom. They say that 64% of U.S. voters say that a growing cancel culture has taken hold of the nation and that they consider it to be a threat to their freedom. Again, that's two-thirds of U.S. voters. The poll found that 36% of Americans said cancel culture is a big problem. 32% called it a moderate problem, 20% called it a small problem, and 13% said it's not a problem. Again, this is a Harvard-Harris poll from the Hill, 1,945 registered U.S. voters conducted March 24th through 25th, very contemporary. So cancel culture, people don't like it. Two-thirds think it's a big problem.
13% said it was no problem?
Yep.
That's all the media people. We've yet to hear an Easter message from President Biden. He is at Camp David this weekend. Take us back a year when President Trump gave his Easter message.
Yes, this was definitely a cultural moment that I took notice of because I like to look and see what people had to say in their proclamations and so forth during a president's time in office. Former President Trump told Americans in a public address from the White House on April the 10th, 2020. He said, "Though we will not be able to gather together with one another as we normally would on Easter, we can use this sacred time to focus on prayer, reflection, and growing in our personal relationship with God. I ask all Americans to pray that God will heal our nation, to bring comfort to those who are grieving, to give strength to the doctors, nurses, and healthcare workers, to restore health to the sick, and to renew the hope in every person who is suffering. Our nation will come through this like never before. I thank the many families who have prayed for me and for my family, and your prayers are felt, and I am forever grateful." And I just thought that was a significant moment for Mr. Trump, probably one that a lot of folks don't remember, but it was just about a year ago.
It's too bad they didn't vote for him. Well, it is Easter weekend, and for millions of Americans, Easter is alive and well. And in this year of the pandemic, what are we expecting to see Americans do this weekend?
Well, I have a very snappy survey from the National Retail Federation. I'm always interested in what they have to say. They're very very precise about what they do, and they reveal in a new retail industry study that 8 out of 10 Americans are going to celebrate Easter. So Easter has not gone today. It has not, the interest has not diminished, and neither has the spending. Gotta love this. Here's what they have to say. The average Easter spending is expected to be the highest on record. And this is the National Retail Federation. Wow. Consumers plan to spend an average of $179.70 this Easter, the highest figure on record. Again, this is coming from the National Retail Federation. They say a total of 79% of Americans will celebrate the holiday and spend a collective $21.6 billion. I'm like, yay. But anyway, moving right along, according to Matthew Shea, he's the president of this retail organization, he says there's a lot of momentum heading into the spring and holiday events like Easter. Many have figured out how to celebrate the holidays safely with family, and that is reflected on consumer spending. He also cites such positive influences as stimulus funds and the fact that more people are getting vaccinations, and there's kind of a slowly growing consumer confidence out there. But he said the biggest driver of all this growth is the purchases of food, Easter gifts, and candy. And the survey also revealed what the heck people are going to be doing. So 59% are going to cook a special meal. 43% will visit with family and friends. 43% will watch TV. Well, 31% will have an Easter egg hunt. 28% will attend church personally. 22% will participate virtually. And last but certainly not least, 24% will connect with their loved ones by phone or video. Again, that's a survey of over 8,000 people, so pretty significant there, coming from the National Retail Federation.
$21.6 billion. That is a lot of peeps. Hmm. Jennifer Harper, Inside the Beltway at the Washington Times. You enjoy your Easter holiday weekend. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Have a good Easter, everybody.
Thank you. It's 6:47, Saturday Morning Update. We'll talk to Jim Trusty next, get the very latest on the Derek Chauvin trial in the death of George Floyd. But first, Al BD is in the WMAL Traffic Center.
On the inner loop of the Beltway in Prince George's County in College Park, crash. Two right lanes are blocked. This is approaching Baltimore Avenue. On Baltimore Avenue in Beltsville, you're going to find construction on the southbound side. Two right lanes are closed between Montgomery Road and Edgewood Road. In D.C. on 295, northbound and southbound on the Anacostia Freeway, there's only one lane getting by the construction. You'll find it between the 11th Street Bridge and Pennsylvania Avenue. And there is no delays on 395 and 695 in the district. And now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Mostly sunny skies on this Saturday. Also some warmer temperatures. Highs yesterday only reached the upper 40s. We should reach the upper 50s, a good 10 degrees warmer for this Saturday. Heading into tonight, low temperatures in the 30s in the suburbs, lower 40s around town. For your Easter Sunday, plenty of sunshine for the day. Temperatures very mild, a gorgeous day ahead of us. High temperatures in the upper 60s. Enjoy your Sunday. I'm 7 News meteorologist Alex Lee at the Stormwatch 7 Weather Center.
Still 28 degrees in the nation's capital, 648 on WMAL.
Washington's Mall, WMAL, where Washington comes to talk.
It is a Saturday morning update on WMAL. Thanks for spending part of your holiday weekend with us. We are joined by Jim Trusty. He is a partner at IFRA Law here in Washington. He is the former chief of the Organized Crime and Gang Section at the U.S. Department of Justice. Jim, good morning.
Hey, Rick. Good morning.
I know you've been watching very closely the trial of Officer Derek Chauvin in the death of George Floyd in Minneapolis. We've probably seen snippets this week on TV, but it hasn't had the full gavel-to-gavel coverage as we saw in the O.J. Simpson trial. So bring us up to speed the first week of testimony, a summary of what you see on the case.
Yeah, I think it's a pretty masterful mix from the prosecution of putting on good witnesses, of pretty sympathetic witnesses, well-spoken, and mixing up, obviously, the use of the video, which is always going to be a central anchor of this case, with the beginnings of the opinions of officers talking about whether Chauvin was essentially breaking from his training and doing something that was unreasonable. So we had kind of a smattering of different witnesses. And, you know, Rick, to go a little bit inside baseball about prosecutors, because I was one for 27 years, they like to start off strong in their case. It's important to have, you know, good witnesses right out of the gate. So if you have a witness that has inconsistent statements or some sort of a bad background, you really don't want to lead with that person. You want the jury kind of eating out of your hand, enjoying the witnesses, liking the people and liking the information they have, and you kind of bury the bad news in between good witnesses. You also try to end your day and your week on a high note. You don't want to go into a holiday weekend with a fizzle, with a bad witness or a witness who's easy to impeach through cross-examination. And so yesterday, that's pretty much how it ended for the government, was putting on Officer Chauvin's superior, Lieutenant Zimmerman. And he basically said this was totally unnecessary conduct, kneeling on George Floyd's neck, and completely against his training. So we're not even really to the expert witnesses yet when it comes to use of deadly force, but it was a pretty powerful condemnation from Chauvin's own supervisor. And that's exactly what you'd want the jury to be taking home with them for the weekend, and that's what the prosecution succeeded in doing.
How would you summarize the defense?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I mean, they're making their points. They're talking about, you know, essentially that they've alleged that the training in Minnesota was exactly to do things like kneel on a person. I mean, I think that's going to be a bit of a tough one to pull off in the grand scheme of things. But they've suggested that there was other causation to the death of Mr. Floyd, then I believe they referred to it as speedballs, but it was basically fentanyl as kind of the lead suspect of a drug cocktail that was in his body. And so, yeah, they have to walk a delicate line. They want to talk about causation of death because that is an important part of a homicide prosecution. But they don't want to sound like they're just dismissive of Floyd as a human being or that they are, you know, gratuitously being nasty about him and his background. So it's a fairly tough kind of sensitive walk. And I think they pulled it off decently in opening statement. But, you know, we'll see. The big battles are still to come.
The role of the medical examiner, how important will this be, and what do we know about conclusions that he's drawn?
Yeah, it's going to be a big battlefield there. It's, and frankly, it's a real minefield for the prosecution because, as I understand it, the original autopsy findings from the medical examiner essentially said that there was no causation from Officer Chauvin. They looked at certain physical artifacts that happen when a person is suffocated. And in this case, they didn't find them. It's petechial hemorrhaging in the eyes, which are like little burst blood vessels, and also damage to the hyoid bone or to the trachea area. And apparently none of that was there. The original medical examiner took kind of this strange middle ground and said, well, he died of cardiac arrest, which is pretty circular. Yes, when someone's heart stops beating, they're not going to keep living. So that was challenged by the prosecutors. And as I understand it, we should expect to see several different medical examiners through the course of this case. It may be the original initial medical examiner is a defense witness. And that's kind of unusual territory for prosecutors. They typically do not go into these fights with their own kind of homegrown medical examiners. And the issue of causation is going to be front and center in front of this jury. It's a very clinical, cold, academic kind of approach to the issue that the defense is going to take. But it is the stuff of reasonable doubt sometimes.
And what about the charges? I understand that there's a manslaughter charge, there's a second-degree murder charge, and a third-degree murder charge?
Yeah, these are very nuanced charges. It's actually pretty difficult stuff, and even folks that have been around the law for a long time have a hard time describing in any real precision the differences between these different degrees of murder. But second-degree murder here is what is normally referred to as felony murder, and in a lot of states, that's a first-degree murder. It's if you're engaging in some sort of crime and the person ends up dying during that, that can be elevated to what's called a felony murder. So here, the excessive force would be the felony assault. And if he died as a result of that, which, you know, that's going to be an argument, then that could be considered second-degree murder, which is punishable by up to 40 years. That's the highest charge on the table. Third-degree murder is what most states have as second-degree murder, not to get too confusing. But third-degree murder here means depraved heart murder. It's essentially there was such a level of recklessness that it contributed or led to the death of Mr. Floyd. And then manslaughter is essentially a gross negligence type offense. It's that he did so many things during the transaction, you know, starting with putting the knee on the neck, not removing it, not giving him the type of medical treatment he could have given him as immediately as he could have. I mean, all of those things could be argued to be a scene of gross negligence, which is a notch below the recklessness that we were talking about for third degree murder, and punishable by only 10 years. So it's very fuzzy lines between these degrees of criminal intent or negligence, but they have pretty serious consequences in terms of what the potential sentence may be.
Jim, I think most people will have heard the name George Gascon. He is the new district attorney in L.A. County. He's made a number of controversial decisions, and one that he made this week that is raising a number of eyebrows is the downsizing of the hardcore gangs unit. And you, having been at the Department of Justice as the chief of the organized crime and gang section, how does this strike you as to the actions being taken in Los Angeles?
Yeah, well, first of all, I'm jealous. We didn't call ourselves the hardcore gang unit. But look, I mean, this is ideology run amok. I mean, Los Angeles is the home of some of the most prolific, violent, sustained gangs, and I'm talking sustained for decades and decades. It's absolutely the key driver to their murder rate. And last year, the murder rate was up significantly. It went up to 350 murders in Los Angeles, up 36%, while the rest of the crime rate was dropping. So it's really kind of an extraordinary tilting of the scales when it came to murders in Los Angeles. I mean, this is the stuff that just, you know, as a former prosecutor, kind of drives me insane, because these are these progressive prosecutors. You're seeing this in L.A., Chicago, St. Louis, Philly. And, you know, they're starting off with something that's really a fiction. They're starting off acting like all they're doing is reforming these horrible, cranky prosecutors' offices that have been so blindly putting everyone in jail for no reason. And that's just not how it's working. I mean, many of the people that have been replaced by progressive, really George Soros-funded radicals here, have had very progressive approaches to law enforcement, not to the point of dismantling something because it sounds scary, but they've had things like teen court, drug court, veterans court. I mean, these are not – most prosecutors that have been at it for a long time are not blindly just saying, let's lock everybody up for as long as we can. They're a little smarter than that. And what you're seeing with folks like Gascon are these categorical decisions. It's a political philosophy. It's not the individualized pursuit of justice. And so, you know, this is a real bad moment for the rank and file citizenry, not just the officers that get knocked out of an important unit, but for the folks that live in Los Angeles that have seen the violence for years and are seeing an uptick. It's going to get worse. And frankly, what I learned from the gangs was that they're actually a little more sophisticated than most people think. I mean, they know about prosecution policies. They know about things like bail reform in New York. They know about the differential treatment for juveniles, which is one reason why they recruit young and have juveniles commit some of the worst crimes. They view all that as weaknesses in the system, and they capitalize on it. So, you know, I don't think I can overstate this situation in Los Angeles. The type of radicalism of saying, oh, hardcore gang unit sounds nasty and we don't need it. I mean, that's the kind of radicalism that's literally going to cause deaths. And, you know, I can only hope that the victim families are going to have a voice as L.A. descends further, because this type of action will guarantee that it does.
In many of these situations where they're defunding the police, it's in the name of social justice or to protect minorities. But when you downsize a gang unit, what communities are being most affected?
Yeah, that's the dirty little secret, Rick. I mean, a lot of the victimization of communities is the most vulnerable communities. It's black on black, Hispanic on Hispanic. It's turf type things where it doesn't spread to the you know, beautiful fenced in neighborhoods. It sticks with the neighborhoods where these guys are living, and it's a horrible existence for the hardworking, law abiding folks that are surrounded by gang members.
Jim Trusty, partner at IFRA Law here in Washington, and we'll be looking for your perspectives next week and as the Chauvin case continues in Minneapolis. Thank you.
Sure, good deal. Thanks for having me.
You bet. 6:59, Saturday Morning Update, WMAL. We'll talk with John Gizzi, the White House correspondent from Newsmax.com, Newsmax TV. We've also got Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer coming up and KT McFarland. Do stay with us. The news is next.
WMAL-FM, Woodbridge, Washington. Now, more than ever, depend on 105.9 FM, WMAL, a Cumulus station.